This is Audible.
Hyperion Audiobooks presents The Essential 55, an award-winning educator's rules for discovering the successful student in every child, written and read by Ron Clark.
Hi, this is Ron Clark. Her name was Mutter. She loved Guiding Light, collards, and snuff, and she was my grandmother. Mother stood right at 5 feet, but when she placed her hands on her hips, she was the tallest person in the room. She was definitely a lady who didn't put up with any nonsense, and she was respected by everyone around her. As I grew up, she lived with my family and had a strong impact on who I am today. She, along with my parents, gave me a true Southern upbringing, which included respect, manners, and an appreciation of others. In addition to those ideals, I was shown how to enjoy life, take advantage of opportunities, and live every moment to the fullest. I was very fortunate to be surrounded by family members who were excellent examples of how life should be lived and not taken for granted. Once I became a teacher, it became evident to me that many children aren't exposed to the type of guidance and opportunities that I had when I was growing up. I have tried to set an example for my students and be a role model. In my attempt to give them an outline or a guide to how life should be lived and appreciated, I compiled this list of lessons. Over the years of working with kids and watching this list grow from 5 rules to a handbook of life's lessons, I have seen a remarkable difference in the way my students have held themselves, performed in school, and had respect for others. I have used these lessons with much success with my students, but they are not only for children. Most of the 55 items listed here can apply to anyone, young or old. I feel so fortunate to have had the opportunity to work with children and develop the list of 55 rules into what it is today. It is an extension of my upbringing mixed with lessons I have learned about life, along with some rules that I have felt the need to adopt in order to maintain order with my students and get them to achieve their potential. However, the rules are more than about getting kids to behave. They're about preparing kids for what awaits them after they leave my classroom. It is about preparing them to handle any situation they may encounter and giving them the confidence to do so. In some ways, it is a 55-step plan. The steps, however, are not sequential. They are all explained, practiced, and enforced from day one in the classroom. At the end of the year, I like to say that my students are polished. I know I can take them anywhere, put them in any situation, and present them with any lesson because they are at a point where they are receptive to learning and eager to experience life. The time I have spent with children and teaching them these lessons has been wonderful, and I can't imagine doing anything other than teaching. That is ironic, however, because when I was growing up, being a teacher was the last thing I would have wanted to do. I wanted to be a reporter or an archaeologist, but never a teacher. And then when I was in college, I found out that my one true love in life is adventure. And I parasailed, and I bungee jumped, and I rappelled off mountains, and I worked at Dunkin' Donuts, and anything adventurous that I could think of doing, I was up for it. And one time when I was working at Dunkin' Donuts, I was working the third shift. I worked from 11 o'clock at night until 7 o'clock in the morning. And I worked with my best friend, Ryan. And we would get bored around 2 o'clock because we wouldn't have many customers. And we would play freeze tag and hide-and-go-seek and all different types of things. And one time we decided to play hide-and-go-seek. And what we would do is we would both go out to the dumpsters, and one of us would stay out there and count, and the other person would go in and hide. So I left Ryan out at the dumpster, and I went inside, and I'm very competitive. So I said, now where can I hide? And I looked over, and I saw this huge oven. We had this huge oven that we used to cook all the muffins and brownies, and it stayed on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I thought to myself, I could fit in that oven. But I was like, well, what if I get too hot? And I figured, well, I'll just crawl out, or I'd say, Ryan, I'm in the oven, let me out. So it all made perfect sense to me. So I went over to this huge oven, and I opened up the door, and I crawled up inside, and I used my sleeves to pull the oven shut, and went click. And I said, oh my goodness. So I took my sleeve and I was trying to get it open and I couldn't open the door. And so I was sitting there waiting. And all of a sudden I heard knock, knock, knock. And he said, you locked me out. And I realized that when I had come in, I had just by force of habit locked the back door. And so I was like, oh my goodness. I said, I'm in the oven. And he said, get out. And I said, I can't. And so I was sitting there thinking, I said, okay, it's 2 o'clock now. The manager will be here at 6 o'clock. And I thought, okay, I'll be cooked by then. What am I gonna do? And so I took off my shoelaces and I was trying to get them through the latch and trying to open the door, and I couldn't. And then I remembered how the week before, when we were playing freeze tag, I had actually crawled through the drive-through window, but Ryan was too big and he couldn't get through it. But I knew that was my only chance, and so I said, crawl through the drive-through! And he yelled, I'll get stuck! And I yelled, I'm burning up! So, all of a sudden, it got silent. And I knew that Ryan must be trying to get through the drive-through window. And I looked down at the bottom of my tennis shoes, and they were starting to melt. And it looked like I had stepped in wads of gum because my tennis shoes were starting to stretch from the bottom of the oven floor. And all of a sudden I heard, I'm stuck. Ryan was stuck trying to get through the drive-thru window with two legs hanging out because he couldn't get through his midsection through the drive-thru. And all of a sudden, this car comes through the drive-thru. And Ryan said these customers said, son, do you need some help? And Ryan said he told them, my friend's cooking in the oven. So anyway, just adventures. That's what my whole life has been about, one adventure after another. And when I graduated from college, I did not want to teach. I really didn't even want to work. I just wanted to have more adventures. And so I moved to London, England. And while I was there, I was a singing and dancing waiter at this restaurant called the Texas Embassy Cantina. And I had to wear this cowboy hat and chaps and spurs, and I had to walk up to every table and talk in a Texas accent. And the customers would always say, oh, you do such a good American accent. And I would say, no, I'm really from America. They'd say, oh, and you play the part so well. And I would say, no, I am really American. So I got really tired of that, and so I finally got a backpack, and I backpacked to Romania, and I was staying with some gypsies because I was looking for the grave of Vlad Dracul, and he was an evil emperor in Romania who started the whole Dracula story, and so I wanted to find his grave. And that night, at 12 o'clock, the gypsies took me to his grave, but before we went, they had fed me some food, and it looked like a link of sausage on a stick. And so I ate it, and I didn't know what it was. And when I was done, I asked, was that pig or hog? What was that? And they told me it was actually rat. I had eaten a rat on a stick. And so anyway, that night at 12 o'clock, when we got to the grave, there was a big 6-foot stone crow at the head of the grave, and I was standing there with the gypsies. And all of a sudden, I had a pain in my stomach. And I was like, oh. I was like, what is that? And I was like, oh. All of a sudden, I started hollering. I was like, oh. And the gypsies thought I was being possessed by Vlad Dracul, and they took off running. But really, I just had food poisoning, and it was so bad, I eventually had to be flown home, and I had food poisoning so bad there were bruises on the inside and outside of my stomach, my appendix was inflamed, I had partial paralysis of my left lung, and I was in bad shape. And I was in the hospital, and I was talking to my mother, and she said, Ron, listen to me. Your father and I, we are so tired of all these adventures you're having. Will you please consider staying here for a while? And you see, I'm from a population 600 town, and my mama sitting there telling me she wanted me to stay was killing me. But she said to me, listen to me, Ron. At the local school, Snowden Elementary School, one of their fifth grade teachers passed away. And the students are devastated, the community is devastated. Will you please consider going to that school and filling in for the rest of the year? Because those kids really need a teacher. And I thought about it, and I knew what the right thing to do would be. And so I said, no, I'm not going to go teach those kids. Are you crazy? But my mom said, Ron, please. And I said, no, Mama, I'm not teaching. I don't want to do that. And she said, well, listen to me. If you don't at least go talk to that principal, your father and I aren't going to support anything that you do from now on forever. Upon arrival, I visited with the principal, Andrea Robertson, who gave me a tour of the school and told me all about the group of students I would teach if I accepted the position. And she was saying, oh, no, let me tell you, you've got all different kinds of learning levels in there. There are LD kids, BEH, some of them just playing BAD. These kids have hit rock bottom and they've started to dig. She said, so come on, Mr. Clark, I'm counting on you. And I was thinking to myself, this lady really thinks I'm going to take this job. She must be crazy. And she said, well, let me introduce you to the students. And so we walked down to the classroom, and she opened the door, and the class was going crazy. Desks were all over the place. They were throwing paper. The poor substitute was up there, and her wig was off to one side, and she had a sandwich in one hand. And I thought to myself, oh, my goodness. And I looked down, and there was this one boy's desk that was pushed all the way up to the door, and he looked up at me, and he had these huge eyes, and he said, is you gonna be our new teacher? And I didn't know what to say. It was just the look on his face, the longing in his face. I could tell how desperate he was. And I said, I think so. And the principal was like, really, really, you are? And I said, yes, I guess. And wouldn't you know that kid that had that longing in his face that, you know, just really pulled me in there and made me become a teacher? Wouldn't you know he turned out to be the worst little hellion in that class? But anyway, I grew to love him, and I grew to love all the kids in that classroom, and I found out that I had been looking all over the world for these adventures and for something to challenge me, and then I found the best adventures and challenges right there within the four walls of that classroom. I fell in love with it, and I knew teaching was what I was meant to do. Before taking over the class myself, the principal wanted me to observe the substitute teacher because she didn't want to just throw me in the class with no idea about what to expect from the group. The substitute in question, Mrs. Waddle, was the eccentric wig and sandwich lady I had observed the first moment I walked in the class. On the first day I observed her, she became upset with a student who didn't know the answer to a question. She proceeded to draw three small circles in a row on the blackboard. And I was like, what is she doing? She then instructed the young man to place his nose in the middle circle and one finger from each hand in the outside circles. She left him there and turned back to the class and asked the question again. The next student got the question right, and she threw her hands in the air and proclaimed that she felt the Holy Spirit. She then sang an entire verse of Amazing Grace, and she actually ended up singing it about three different times that day when kids got questions right. I mean, sitting there and watching this teacher for a week solidified more and more each day my desire to work with those students. They needed me more than I could have ever imagined. Before turning the class over to me, the substitute left me with one bit of wisdom. She looked at me and said, you know, Mr. Clark, you'll be fine. As long as you can affect the life of one child, you've been a success. To this day, I do not like that quote. I mean, I feel we have to approach education with the determination to affect each and every one of our students. The mentality of achieving success after reaching one child isn't enough. I approach each year with the knowledge that I have only 1 year to make a life's worth of difference in each child in that classroom, and I give it everything I've got. Over the next 7 years in the classroom, my experiences were like a roller coaster ride with invitations to the White House, 911 calls, trips around the country with students, projects that garnered worldwide attention, and a major move from teaching in rural North Carolina to Harlem in New York City. Those events highlight my time spent working with children and my efforts to teach them these 55 rules. I have recounted many of the stories here. They show the highs and lows, successes and disappointments, and lessons learned along the way. As you go through the list, there are some rules you may like and decide to use with students and children in your life, and there may be some that don't inspire you. We all have different levels of tolerance when it comes to the behavior of children, and we all have different levels of expectations for ourselves and others. I offer these rules as suggestions, as tried and true methods that have served my students well. I hope you find them useful. Rule number one. When responding to any adult, you must answer by saying, yes, ma'am, or no, sir. Just nodding your head or saying any other form of yes or no is not acceptable. Because I grew up in rural North Carolina, this one comes naturally to me. I feel it is one of the most important of all the rules because it sets the tone for the type of respect I expect from my students. If you want children to respect you, you have to let them know it. Simply by telling them you want them to address you by saying, sir, lets them know the way you expect them to treat you. I also tell my students it's a very useful tool when dealing with adults, and furthermore, it also comes in handy for any adult interacting with another adult. Case in point, I was on the phone recently with the phone company discussing the inaccuracies of my bill because it is never right. The lady I spoke to was not helpful and seemed annoyed. Then, in the midst of the conversation, I threw in a, "Yes, ma'am," and her entire attitude changed. She became far more helpful and easy to deal with. It seems like just such a simple thing to do, but it gets results. Rule number 2, make eye contact. When someone is speaking, keep your eyes on him or her at all times. If someone makes a comment, turn and face that person. Keeping eye contact is something that many people find hard to do, but it is important when you are trying to get your point across to people and show them you are serious about what you are saying. For example, if you go in to talk to your boss and ask for a raise, he is going to be far more likely to take you seriously if you are looking him in the eyes rather than glancing downward. If you are making a business proposal, people will be more likely to trust you and believe in your ideas if they see that you are confident, sure of yourself, and making eye contact with them. Making eye contact is not only a way to show confidence, but it is also an important way to show respect. In class, when a student is expressing an opinion, I make sure all of the other students turn and are focused on that individual. I don't allow them to raise their hands to make additional comments until that person is finished because, if they do, it looks as if they are more concerned with what they want to say than with the opinions of the speaker. I tell them to imagine what it would be like if they were trying to express a thought and everyone around them kept waving their hands. It would make them feel like their opinions had no value, and so therefore, we don't do it. I have worked many a day waiting tables at various restaurants. Serving the public can be a thrill, but it can also be torture when you have to deal with difficult customers. I can remember how I always liked it when people would look me in the eyes to give their order. It is far more respectful to look a person in the face. As they were leaving, I always expected them to say thank you, but many didn't, and it baffled me. What were they thinking? Many who did say thank you just said it as they turned away or drove off from the drive-thru. Why not take 1 second to look the person in the eyes and say thank you as if you mean it? I try to get my students to practice doing this with various adults in the school who aren't teachers. Often custodians, cafeteria workers, secretaries, and teachers' aides aren't considered worthy of the respect teachers get. And I work hard to change that image in the minds of my students. I explain to the students the role of each person at the school and how his or her job makes it possible for kids to get a great education. I tell them that people work harder and with more effort if they feel they are appreciated and that they are making a difference. I make sure I model the type of behavior I expect as I interact with all members of the staff in a friendly and respectful manner. No matter how we are interacting with others around us, and regardless of what we are saying, we will be taken more seriously and our actions will be much more appreciated if they come with sincerity and eye contact. Rule number 3. If someone in the class wins a game or does something well, we will congratulate that person. Claps should be of at least 3 seconds in length, with the full part of both hands meeting in a manner that will give the appropriate clap volume. I know stating it like that makes me sound like a nut, but the kids love it and we have a lot of fun practicing this rule. Think about a football or basketball game. What happens when someone scores a touchdown or makes a winning basket? The crowd goes crazy and cheers for that person. I think we should have that type of supportive environment and camaraderie in all areas where we have to work together to achieve goals, whether it be the workplace, the home, or especially the classroom. Anytime people are given praise and rewarded for their efforts, they are going to do a better job. That is obvious. But for some reason, there are still parents who aren't cheering their kids on, and principals and other leaders who just aren't creating the type of atmosphere where colleagues are celebrating each other's achievements. Rule number 4. During discussions, respect other students' comments, opinions, and ideas. When possible, make statements like, "I agree with John, and I also feel that," or, "Oh, I disagree with Sarah. Oh, she made a good point, but I feel differently. I feel that," or, "I think Victor made an excellent observation, and it made me realize." This is a rule I feel should be imposed in every boardroom and meeting in every workplace in America, as well as at every family dinner table. Too often we disregard the comments of others and don't set the type of climate that will allow people to speak freely and voice their thoughts and opinions. All too often, people are worried about what others will think of their ideas and that they will be ridiculed or belittled and that their comments will be disregarded. I imagine there are hundreds of times every day when the best idea in the room goes unheard or isn't even voiced. I knew I did not want that type of environment in my classroom, so I developed a system with my kids that would create a supportive and non-threatening atmosphere. I wanted to have more than just a class where students were allowed to give their opinions. I wanted those thoughts and ideas to develop into a discussion with a mutual appreciation for all opinions. For this to happen, I found it was necessary to teach the students step by step how to tell each other that they agree or disagree with the other's comments in a respectful and supportive way. The first thing I tell my students is that we will never laugh or make fun of someone's questions, answers, or ideas. Every person in the class has something to contribute, and in order for our class to be the best it can be, we need to hear the opinions and ideas of everyone. I tell them that it is okay to disagree, and that it is only human to not agree with everyone about everything. I point out, though, that there is a correct way and an incorrect way to let your feelings be known. We are each different, with different gifts, different experiences, and different roads that we have been down. There is no way to know all of the things that make up your neighbor's ideas. Therefore, we should just appreciate each other's statements without being condescending or making them feel their way of thinking isn't right. Now, we practice this a great deal. And for many of the students, it is as if they are listening to one another's statements and taking value in what other people are saying for the first time. I can tell my students over and over how much I appreciate something they have said or that they have made a very smart comment. But when a peer turns and says, "Wow, that was a great idea. I didn't think of that," it is valuable beyond words for that child's self-esteem and confidence. It is very similar to how it is wonderful to hear praise from our moms, but it can mean more to us when those positive comments and acceptance come from our coworkers. Creating that type of environment where everyone supports each other and shows appreciation for the thoughts and abilities of others makes a world of difference in a classroom or in any other group of people who are trying to work together. Rule number 5. If you win or do well at something, do not brag. If you lose, do not show anger. Instead, say something like, "I really enjoyed the competition and I look forward to playing you again," or "good game," or don't say anything at all. To show anger or sarcasm, such as, "I wasn't playing hard anyway, you really aren't that good," shows weakness. If you are good at something, others will recognize it. There is no need to tell others how talented you are because by bragging about yourself, you are seen in a negative light, and people won't care about what skills you may have. This is obviously hard for many people to realize because we seem to live in a culture where everyone wants to put their accomplishments and abilities on display. I tell my students that sometimes it is hard for people to stand back and not talk about their abilities, but if they can, it will make their skills seem much larger when they are realized by others. Rule number 6. If you are asked a question in conversation, you should ask a question in return. For example, if I say, "Did you have a nice weekend?" You say, "Yes, I had a great time. My family and I went shopping. What about you? Did you have a nice weekend?" It is only polite to show others that you are just as interested in them as they are in you. This is a skill that takes a while to learn. Actually, I have met many adults who have yet to master it. And in all honesty, many never will. I tell my students that when they are talking to someone, they should make sure not to monopolize the conversation. We have all encountered that person who just won't shut up, and I don't want any of my students to grow up to be that type of person. I want them to understand that you are far more likable and respectful when you are asking about the thoughts and opinions of others. It is simply an easy way to let someone know that you are interested in who they are and what they have to say. And this rule is so important to me, but actually one time it backfired on me. I spend so much time working with the kids on how to be a good conversationalist, and if they walk in my classroom and I say, "Hey, Derek, did you have a nice weekend?" And he says, "Yeah, Mr. Clark, it was great." I say, "No, Derek, come back here." You should say, "Yes, Mr. Clark, I had a great weekend. What about you? Did you have a nice weekend?" And so I really drill this into the kids. And one time I had a group of kids go to be interviewed to get in this really good junior high school in New York City. And after they were each interviewed individually, the man who was in charge of the interview committee called me and he said, "Mr. Clark, we could certainly tell all of your kids from the other kids that we interviewed." And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, one of the questions that we asked on the interview was, can you name some of your favorite books and some of the favorite authors you've been reading?" And every last one of your kids would name some favorite books they have and some of their favorite authors. And then every one of them would say, "How about you on the committee? Can you name some of your favorite authors and some of the favorite books you are reading?" So it kind of backfired on me that time, but it's an important rule. Teaching kids to be good conversationalists and to respect the ideas and opinions of others, I think, is essential. Rule number 7. When you cough or sneeze or burp, it is appropriate to turn your head away from others and cover your mouth with the full part of your hand. Using a fist is not acceptable. Afterward, you should say, "Excuse me." This one seems so simple, but it is surprising how many kids have never been told to do this. Actually, I notice adults all the time who cough and sneeze in public without placing a hand over the mouth. I absolutely hate riding the subway in New York during cold and flu season because it is inevitable that someone is going to stand right behind me and cough or sneeze right on my neck. One important thing I point out to the kids is that after they sneeze or cough on their hand, they should wash their hands as soon as possible. Otherwise, they will be passing those germs along to everything and everyone they touch. Rule number 8. Do not smack your lips, tisk, roll your eyes, or show disrespect with gestures. So much time and trouble is saved by getting this rule out of the way. I doubt there is a person in America who hasn't had someone smack their lips, the sound is also known as a tisk in some areas, or roll their eyes at him or her during one time or another. Kids, especially teenagers, love to do it. But I have been able to eliminate it entirely from my classes just by pointing it out and making a rule that it will not happen in my classroom. Rule number 9. Always say thank you when I give you something. If you do not say it within 3 seconds after receiving the item, I will take it back. There is no excuse for not showing appreciation. In my opinion, this one is major. I cannot tell you the countless times I have had to take things away from students who forgot to say thank you. They're always surprised at the beginning of the year at what happens when I am handing out cookies at lunch or homework passes and students forget to say thank you. I take the item back, and they honestly believe I am just joking and that I'm going to wait a few seconds and then give them a second try. It never happens. In order for this rule to work, you have to enforce it. And sometimes that is difficult. One time, a student, along with 4 other kids, won a set of books for having the highest score on a social studies test. The little girl was so excited that she was jumping up and down. Others in the class quickly pointed out that after she sat down, she had forgotten to say thank you. And I had to take the books away from her. It broke my heart. I was so upset. But once I went with the rule, I wouldn't turn back. I had to remain consistent. The kids understood that and rarely complained when I had to take things away from them. They knew it was a rule, and I had stated explicitly the way it worked from day one. And you know, I know this seems really harsh, and I'm sure some of you are thinking that the idea of me taking those books away from that little girl is just really a terrible thing to do. But as a parent or a teacher, you have to be consistent. You have to be fair, and you have to stick to what you say. That is the only way you're going to build trust and respect with those kids. And I mean, sometimes being strict really pays off. There was this one kid, his name was Montrell, and I taught him fifth grade, and I recently received a phone call from his 12th grade teacher, and she said, "Is this Mr. Clark?" And I said, "Yes." Yeah. She said, "Well, I just wanted to call and thank you so much." And I said, "Why?" And she said, "My entire class of 12th graders are so disrespectful, but there's this one student in there called Montrell, and he's the most respectful student, and he always says thank you and yes, ma'am, and he's so helpful and generous." And I asked him one day, I said, "Well, Montrell, you're such a polite young man, and you always say thank you. Where did you learn these wonderful manners?" And he said, "Well, I learned them from my Mr. Clark, my fifth grade teacher, because I'm going to tell you right now, he meant what he said, and he taught us how to be respectful." And when she said that to me, it just really hit me. You know, I taught him fifth grade, and this kid was in 12th grade. That if you can really, really make a difference in the lives of children, if you can really teach them values and morals and how to respect others, it will stick with them. They'll remember it. And that's a powerful thing. I don't think we realize that as teachers or parents, what we are teaching students and what we are saying to them and the example we're setting for them, it really sticks. It stays in their minds and they'll remember it. And we are really making a difference. And I think many times we don't even realize how big of an impact we're making. Rule number 10. When you are given something from someone, never insult that person by making negative comments about the gift or by insinuating that it wasn't appreciated. 1 month, I took all of the top readers in the class to a Charlotte Hornets pro basketball game. They got to stay overnight in a hotel, meet the players, and have a blast at the game. The following month, the top readers were going to be rewarded with a trip to the local bowling alley. The disparity is hard to miss, and it definitely didn't go unnoticed by the students. They were vocal about the difference in the trips, and it really hurt my feelings. I mean, most teachers weren't taking their students on any trips at all, yet mine were complaining that the bowling trip wasn't nice enough. In order to teach them a lesson, I canceled the bowling trip and gave them no reward. It may seem harsh to cancel the trip, but it was a very effective way to get my point across to the ungrateful students, and hopefully the memory of why they were punished will be a lasting one. It's so irritating to give a gift that's not appreciated. As a side note, I want you to know that I'm not only teaching kids to go through the motions of showing appreciation. I spend a lot of time talking with them about being grateful when others help them and why it is a special thing when someone goes out of their way to make a difference in their lives. Rule number 11. Surprise others by performing random acts of kindness. Go out of your way to do something surprisingly kind and generous for someone at least once a month. All of the kids love this rule, and it sounds as if it is a really good idea, and then it would be a lot of fun. The problem is that it is one of the hardest of the rules for people to follow. In our daily lives, we get so busy and preoccupied that there isn't much time to sit down and think up a surprise for someone. Usually, if it isn't someone's birthday or a special occasion, people really don't see a need to go out of their way to do something special for someone else. I feel, however, that the best time to give someone a nice surprise is when it isn't expected. That way, the person knows you didn't do it because of obligation. You did it because you wanted to. The types of surprises I'm talking about are more than just getting someone a gift. These surprises need to be more thought out and meaningful. For example, take the time to make a lunch, complete with salad, entree, and dessert, and set it up in a room where you work. Place flowers on the table and play some soft music in the background. Then invite the custodians to take a break and enjoy the lunch you prepared for them. Or, when your neighbors are at work, mow their lawn and clip their hedges. I tell my students that they can clean their room, vacuum the house, or do the dishes without being asked to. They can do errands or read to an elderly neighbor, or they can take someone fresh flowers. The opportunities are all around. The reason behind my desire to surprise others stems from how my parents were constantly arranging surprises for my sister and me. I remember how seeing them go out of their way to do kind and unexpected things for us made me feel so special and loved. I promised myself that when I was older, I was going to do similar things for all of those around me. When I became a teacher, I found myself spending hundreds of dollars a month on books, contest prizes, and many other items for the students. Small surprises like that were appreciated by the kids, but then something happened. I started a project with the kids that led to the biggest surprise I had ever been involved with. It forever changed my life and the lives of the students. It all started when I was teaching a lesson on the newspaper, and the students were having trouble understanding how the classified ads worked. So I said, okay, tomorrow all of you bring a nickel and we'll put our own ad in the paper, because I just wanted to give them ownership to the project. I then instructed them to come up with an ad for the classifieds. Immediately, they wanted to place a Lexus for sale in the automobiles for sale section, but then I had to remind them, we don't have a Lexus. And they were like, oh, my Uncle Leroy has one, we can sell his Lexus. And I was like, no, we are not selling Uncle Leroy's Lexus. But finally, we decided to place a geography puzzle in the paper and ask readers to write us back with the answer. Our first puzzle stated, what is the largest island in the world? If you know the answer, please write to our class. We included our address and anxiously waited to see if we would get a response. To our surprise, we received 10 letters from different individuals around the area. The kids loved it because no one had the right answer, and they got to write each person back with the correct answer, Greenland. The kids were so excited with the letters we received that we decided to place additional puzzles and papers all across the state. The project became less about a lesson on the classifieds and more about what the students were learning from all of the people who were writing our class. In order to get more responses, we marched in parades with banners that had questions painted on them, along with a request to send answers to our school. We passed out flyers at local supermarkets and even placed a puzzle on a radio show. Soon, we were receiving dozens of letters a day from people all across the state, from doctors, lawyers, Arabian horse farm owners, people from all kinds of professions. My students in our small town of 600 people were learning about life outside of our town. The whole process was essential for these kids who had very little experience of life beyond our community. The kids were thoroughly enjoying the project when one day a boy named Luke said, hey, Mr. Clark, I've been thinking, and I think we need to go worldwide. And I was like, what do you mean, Cole? And what he meant was that he thought we should put an ad in a paper that would go all around the world. And it sounded like a good idea to me, so I decided to send Luke to the office to call USA Today in order to find out how much a 4x5-inch ad would cost in their paper. When Luke returned, he placed his hands on his hips and informed me seriously in his deep southern drawl, Mr. Clark, you better sit down. I was like, what is it, Cole? Just tell me. And he proceeded to tell me that it was going to cost $12,000 to place a 4x5-inch ad in the USA Today paper. And I said, oh, Cole, you must be mistaken. You must have misunderstood. I'll call myself after school. So I did, and it is $12,000. Can you believe that? I couldn't believe it. And I told the kids, I said, kids, there is no way that we can raise that much money. But the kids were like, yes, we can, Mr. Clark. Come on, we can do it. And I was like, no, there's no way we can raise $12,000 for an ad. But they were like, come on, Mr. Clark, we can do it. So finally I started thinking, and I realized, you know, we probably won't be able to raise $12,000, but these kids will really learn a good, valuable lesson about how much $12,000 really is. And so I said, okay. I said, we'll do any kind of fundraiser you want. We can have a bake sale, a candy sale, anything but a car wash. I hate car washes. After about a month, we only had about $800. And no, I was about to tell the kids it was time for us to give it up when I got a phone call. And I went to the phone and I said, well, hello. And the lady said, hello, Mr. Clark. My name is Joan Barlotto and I'm the editor at USA Today. How are you doing? And I said, fine. How are you? She said, good. I said, good. And she said, I've got some very exciting news for you. I said, well, you do? What is it? And she said, a gentleman saw you on the news trying to raise your money to put an ad in our paper, and he wants to give you the $12,000. And I said, get out of here. And she said, no, I'm serious. I said, well, what's his name? And she said, well, you know, it's right before Christmas, and he wants to remain anonymous, so he only wants to be known as Santa Claus. And I said, oh, my goodness. So I ran to the class, and I said, kids, you're not going to believe it. Someone saw us on the news trying to raise our money for our ad, and they're going to give us $12,000. And those kids went crazy. They were jumping up and down and hollering and high-fiving. And Luke looked at me, and he said, well, Mr. Clark, who gave us that money? And I grinned, and I said, Santa Claus. And Luke said, Mr. Clark, my parents ain't got that kind of money. So anyway, I decided to let the students pick the puzzle that would appear in the USA Today newspaper. And here's the question they picked. Attention, President Clinton and people around the world. What kills more people each year than AIDS, alcohol abuse, car accidents, murders, suicides, illegal drugs, and fires combined? And when the kids told me that was the question they picked, I said, well, golly, y'all, that's a really good question. What's the answer? And they said, tobacco use. And I said, oh, kids, I said, oh, I see. I said, don't y'all realize we come from North Carolina, the number one tobacco producing state? And this little girl named Carmika said, well, you know, Mr. Clark, just because we come from this state doesn't mean we can't have our own opinions. And she had a point. So, in addition to the question, we placed our address and fax numbers in the ad and anxiously awaited the responses. Unfortunately, coming from such a rural school, we didn't have email at that time and couldn't include an internet address. On the day the ad appeared, I wasn't even able to get a paper because USA Today isn't delivered to our rural area. The effects of the ad were felt, however, as we had already received over 100 faxes before I even arrived at school. As I pulled into the parking lot, my mild-mannered co-teacher, Barbara Jones, was jumping up and down and cheering, Mr. Clark, Mr. Clark, you've got to get to the office. Stop the car. I'll park it for you. So I jumped out, and she parked the car, and as I ran into the office, the first fax I picked up and read was from the Prime Minister of Canada. There were also faxes from the cast of Friends, sports teams, doctors in Bombay, India, and people from everywhere you can imagine. When the students arrived at school, we took over the office. Radio shows all over the country were reading our ad on the air and asking their listeners to call in with their answers. The radio shows were then calling our school to find out what the real answer was. So there were kids on three different phone lines talking to thousands of listeners. I had kids out in the hall being interviewed by TV reporters, faxes coming in constantly from all over the world, and students about to jump through the roof with excitement. And you know, as a teacher or a parent, when your kids or students are doing something like that, you like to stand over them and guide them and watch them throughout the process. Well, I had lost all control. I had all those kids out in the hall being interviewed and kids doing radio interviews, and I was on one phone on one radio interview in Chicago, and Carmika was doing one radio interview. And then I looked all the way down in the principal's office. On the red phone was Luke. And he was on the largest radio talk show in New York City. And he was just a-talking. And he was just a-going. And his arms were flailing all over the place. And I was like, Lord only knows what that boy is saying. But it was exciting. And it was wonderful. And those kids who, when I first started teaching, had their heads down and they weren't excited. There was no passion in their eyes. These kids were coming to life. And these kids were saying to me, Mr. Clark, I want to take home 10 letters tonight. Can I write back 10 people? I want to write back 15 people. These kids were so excited and they were learning and they were truly living and enjoying their time in school. And it was a wonderful experience. When that first day of receiving faxes was finally over, we realized that the fax machine was going to be going all night, and that no one would be there to keep paper in the machine, and that we would lose a lot of responses. Therefore, I had to spend the night in the school office. Faxes came in constantly throughout the entire night. Around 3 a.m., I got one that said, "Mr. Clark, call us!" And a number was attached. Well, I didn't know who in the world it was, but I called, and it was a casino that had posted the question and was taking bets on the answer. They were calling me to confirm the correct answer so they could pay out the winners. It was wild. It was so much fun to learn about the various individuals and to hear all of their responses to our question. Here are some of our more common and favorite responses to our question about what kills so many people. The answers were starvation, guns, falls in the bathtub, James Bond, love, heart attack, abortion, old age, suspense, ignorance, the fifth grade, time, greed, the tongue, hangnails, and puzzles. So as you can see, some very clever answers, and we eventually received over 8,000 letters and packages from all over the world. We had promised in the ad to write each person back, so the kids had to meet on Saturdays, during holidays, and after school in order to handwrite each individual a response, letting each person know that the correct answer is tobacco use. The students were becoming local celebrities, being featured on national news programs and on the covers of newspapers all across the state. A great deal of excitement surrounded the project, and the kids were starting to hold their heads high and come to school each day on top of the world. After a week of writing letters, turning the school office into our own makeshift headquarters, and being the center of media attention, we finally received the answer we had been waiting for. A representative from the White House called and said that Hillary Clinton would be calling on Friday at 11:45 a.m. to give the president's and her answer and to discuss the dangers of tobacco use with the students. And then the representative told me that Mrs. Clinton was so impressed with the project that she was actually going to invite the students to come to Washington, D.C. to spend Christmas with her and the president. I didn't know what to say. I was so floored, and I said, "Oh my goodness, that is so wonderful. So how is this going to work? Are you going to send me a check, or how am I supposed to get the kids there?" And no, she was not going to send me a check. She told me that we would have to arrange the funding for the trip ourselves. And so I talked to the principal and I said, "You know, Miss Robertson, we've got to take these kids. What a wonderful experience." And she said, "Mr. Clark, you listen to me. You are not going to go in that classroom and tell those kids they're going to Washington, D.C. because it's right before Christmas. These parents don't have money to spend to send their kids up on a trip. And unless you can arrange funding, no kids are going. None of them. Because unless they can all go, none of them are going to go." I said, "Okay." So